No amount of loving can stop the dog from barking when she's in pain. That's Dizzy. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Jays take another loss yesterday, 6-3 to the Cincinnati Reds. Pretty fun day down at the ballpark in general. I know it maybe didn't seem like that, but there's some, you know, buzz around Ellie De La Cruz being here. There are obviously a bunch of questions on the text line and on social media about whether Joey Votto would be there. The Reds are just like, I think the Reds have one of the best aesthetics in the league. Like, they're out there, all their guys warm up in just like Cincinnati Reds basketball jerseys, which is, I don't know, just to mix it up or whatever. But it's a good aesthetic matchup. If the Blue Jays wear their baby blues at any point in this series too, it'll be a nice one. And then, hey, you get a moonshot from Vlad, who had the world's shortest cold streak over the weekend. He went, I think, 1-for-12 with a walk or two walks. That's behind him. Absolute moonshot. You get Julian Aguilar making his major league debut on short notice, as Julia Kreutz wrote about for MLB.com. Such a short notice after Hunter Green hit the IL that there was passport confusion and scramble and things like that. But he makes it. And then, yeah, he gives the Reds four decent innings. He gives up two runs. There's the Vlad moonshot on a hung slider. Aguilar told Julia Kreutz after the game that, you know, kind of like tongue in cheek, like, hey, what a guy to give it up to get that one out of the way. The first career major league home run surrendered to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the middle of this like 2 month heater. Pretty cool for him. Varsho got to him for an RBI single as well that scored a George Springer double. And that was it off of him. The bullpen carried the Reds from there. Only one run over five innings. That was an Ernie Clement solo shot. It's funny. We talked yesterday on the show about Ernie Clement being the anti three true outcomes guy. The guy who doesn't strike out, who doesn't walk and has a couple of home runs, but he's not like a 40 homer guy. And then he had a walk and a homer in the same game, making me look silly. We also talked a bunch yesterday about Ellie De La Cruz and his, this was more on Blue Jay Central than on our show, but he is one stolen base away from becoming just the fifth player in history to have a 20 homer, 60 stolen base season. Ricky Henderson's done it three times. There's Joe Morgan, a couple other names on that list. Ronald Acuna Jr. And then I think Eric Davis is the other one. And it's only happened seven times across those four players. De La Cruz has been stuck on 20 and 59 for a while now. He hasn't stole a base in 10 games. He's only had four opportunities during that stretch where he was on first base with no one in front of him. Only went once and was caught stealing that on that one instance. But yeah, it'd be something to watch. Kevin Gausman was on paper a guy to get that 60th steal against. The Jays actually threw out a base runner with Kevin Gausman on the mound last night. So they're now, base runners are now 18 for 19 against Gausman. On the Gausman side, he went five, looked okay. Velocity was down across all his pitches again, though. And then, allowed two base runners in the sixth. One of those on a Alejandro Kirk passed ball after a strikeout, and things kind of unraveled from there. Ryan Burke came in, allowed a couple more runs to score with a series of doubles from the Reds. And that opened things up, and that's where it landed, a 6-3 loss for the Blue Jays. The Reds coming off, swept the team, then got swept. They need a sweep here to keep their wild card chances alive here. Let's talk about the Jays side of this. We will talk about the Reds side. We'll talk to C. Trent Rosecrans in a little bit here. We've got Mike Petriello and Shai Davidi coming on a little later. So if you're looking for analysis of Chris Bassett's comments later, Shai Davidi got to speak with him yesterday. We'll talk to Shai about that more. Right now, though, let's take a look at this game. Let's look a little closer at Kevin Gausman. Let's talk to Joe Siddle of Sportsnet. Joe, on Zoom, no less. What a treat. What a treat. Thanks for doing this morning.
You didn't catch me out on my bike this morning, so I'm good. I'm good for you on Zoom today, Blake.
Is that the routine? Like when you're in town, like take the bike to the water if it's nice enough since you're right downtown.
You know, I bounce back and forth. I like to get a workout in my building here, maybe every other day. A bike ride the other day. So you got to get outside for an hour or so at least, and a little cooler, but the sun is shining.
There you go. No golf course today, I guess. So last night, Joe, Kevin Gausman continued this stretch of, you know, we've heard him talk about, hey, you know, it's been a mental grind this season. He hasn't said necessarily it's a physical grind, but the velocity was down on a lot of his pitches again yesterday. What have you made of, over these last couple starts, him shifting to more of a pitch to contact guy instead of a swing and miss guy? Is that just kind of out of necessity with where he's at physically right now, do you think?
I think it could be out of necessity, and it's just that realization that, you know, when we kind of talk about Bassett and Gausman and Barrios in a similar light, these are veteran guys that have logged a lot of innings, and We don't know if that's the answer, but the first thing I look to when I see a Kevin Gausman having a year like this, and I know it kind of started with the shoulder injury, but it just makes you think, like, there are a lot of miles on that arm, and you're not getting younger, and you're not necessarily getting sharper and going to just hone your skills more and more. I think more so with the conversation with guys like that is they have to continue to learn how to pitch with what they have. We saw him develop a sinker this year right away. For me, that was not a red flag, but it's a good thing because it's a veteran pitcher making an adjustment to what he's seeing, and that, hey, I've got to come up with another weapon here. What I've got just isn't right. We've seen the strikeouts come down. He's not getting the swing and miss like we saw earlier. And we all know, I think, over the last couple of years, I mean, when Kevin's at his best, it's when he's 95, 96 at the top of the zone, nasty splitter down, and it just hasn't been that way. So he's trying to figure it out. A lot of foul balls, a lot of tough counts where he just can't put people away. And I mean, that home run that Friedel hit, I think it was 89 miles per hour.
Yeah.
I mean, so the velocity is a weird thing. I talked to Kevin about that way earlier back in the season, and he said, you know, not that it doesn't matter to him, but it's hard to control. He said he'll come out. He doesn't always know the radar readings and the velocities. Like that 89-mile-per-hour fastball, maybe he thought it was 93. You don't know. But he said, I could be 94, and it feels like 91. I could be 91, it feels like 95. So he doesn't necessarily have that great feel. I think as a catcher, you have a really good feel because you can tell how the ball is popping. And that's why, and I've said it for years, I mean, pitching coaches need to talk to the catchers in that fifth inning when pitchers are starting to tire and ask them. And I've had pitching coaches do that for years. They ask the catcher how things are back there. You've got the best seat in the house. You're receiving everything. And we can just see it's just not the same stuff from Kevin Gausman right now.
Yeah, I remember back the Detroit game you guys did with no power when you guys had to do the cell phone. That was a Gausman start. And he said, he's like, yeah, I think it was a good thing that we didn't have radar guns for that one, because I thought my stuff wasn't there, and maybe the Tigers would have picked up on it. So in terms of the catcher, like that's a good note that, you know, Pete Walker and those guys talking to you, to Kirk and Brian Servant, about what they're seeing. You behind the plate, when you see that the, you know, and whether this is the radar reading or just how you feel in there, the fastball doesn't quite have it that day, or the splitter isn't getting, you know, it's still moving, but it's not getting the depth. It's moving a little in front of the plate instead of at the back of the plate. What are you doing to try to help Gausman along? Are you calling the sinker a little bit more? Are you just mixing up locations? How do you handle that from the catcher perspective?
Well, with other pitchers that have more pitches, you can go to plan B and C, but Kevin's fairly one-dimensional with the four-seamer and the split, right? Yes, he's developed the sinker, and yes, he mixes in the slider, but I wouldn't count on those pitches being difference makers by any means. So you are limited, and that's what makes it very difficult for Gausman. And, you know, he's been so good with his two weapons, it tells you how good those weapons were. Like, to do it with two pitches, it's remarkable as a starting pitcher. So yeah, I'm not a fan of a slider. I'm not one to say, okay, let's go to plan B. Let's throw the slider more to righties, because I think you're asking for trouble if you do that. The big thing is the fastball's getting hammered, right? And when the fastball's getting hammered, you're really limited with your options. If they're laying off or fouling off the splitter, you're kind of backed into a corner. And that's where Kevin's at right now. It's just where he is at. And, I don't think there are other avenues where you can go. Location is obviously critical, but he's not a location guy. I mean, he's more fastball top of the zone. And we've seen him, the one big adjustment he's made over the last season or two is he's used fastball down in the zone more. And that's good, because the fastball up and the fastball down for him, when it has decent velocity, those are like two different pitches. But man, when that velo comes down, I'm not a big proponent of, oh, you have to throw hard to be a good pitcher, but let's not kid ourselves. I'll take 95, 96 back there anytime with anyone before you see kind of a guy like Kevin struggling the way he is with the velo down.
Well, and if you throw 89, it better be on the edge. It better not be in the middle like it was yesterday. I pulled this stat when I was scouting Justin Steele on the weekend, because he's near the top of the league and he'll just throw a fastball over the middle of the plate, but he's got like three or four different kind of tweaks on his four-seam fastball. But Gausman, the only guy ahead of him on the list in terms of how often have you thrown your fastball middle this year. When you hear that stat that Gausman's thrown it down the chute more than any other pitcher in baseball, what does that tell you? Is that like a, you know, because to me, I'm like, okay, well, he can't locate, you know, the splitter you don't want in the zone a ton. He doesn't have a great feel for the slider and sinker to pick the edge and stuff like that. So maybe he just has to get it over. But I don't know, that's worrisome to me, that like the fastball is not getting spotted. It's just kind of here it is.
Well, not just that it's not getting spotted, but it doesn't have all of the other characteristics I'm sure that a Justin Steele's fastball has. And I'm sure you can go in much greater detail than I can regarding his release points and the way it's coming out of his hand and the axis of rotation and the spin rate and on and on and on. That's when you see a guy that's just got what looks to be like an average fastball velocity, 91, 92, 93, but it's a very successful pitch. It's a very good pitch. You would do it way better than me, but you got to dig deeper and say, what is this pitch doing? Because clearly, and hitters will tell you, like, you could face a guy that's throwing 91, 92, and the guy goes six shutout innings, and I'll ask hitters the next day, like, what was it about his fastball? And they're like, dude, I just couldn't pick it up. I couldn't pick it up, his arm angle or whatever it was, whether it's delivery, release point. There are several factors that provide deception, but also the ride that some fastballs have more than others. And I would just venture to guess that Gausman's fastball is, if it did it better before, it's certainly not doing it as well now, because you look at his fastball, whether the velocity is 91 or 95, it's generally getting hit pretty hard right now all season. And that tells me that there isn't a lot of deception or life. Sometimes your secondary pitch, for him, the splitter, can help with that deception, but that's not the case, obviously.
Yeah, Joe, I wanted to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, which is the workload that Gausman's undergone. And I've used this stat on Blue Jay Central a couple times that Berríos, Gausman, Bassett are all top eight in innings pitched since the start of 2021. So coming out of the pandemic season. With Gausman, if you go back to 2016, when he kind of became a full-time guy, Aaron Nola, Patrick Corbin, Gerrit Cole, those are the only guys who have thrown more than Kevin Gausman over the last, we're talking about almost a decade of pitches now. We're talking over 1,400 innings. When it comes to how they manage the rest of this year, and we've talked to John Schneider about it a little bit, how much is that on your radar when you're looking ahead to how these guys are going to look in 2025, whether it's Bassett and Gausman or Berríos or just one of them? You know, they're obviously going to have some say in their workloads down the stretch, but how much would that be front of mind for you if you're the Blue Jays and you're plotting out these next 6 weeks?
Well, if I'm the Blue Jays plotting out my next 6 weeks, and I've been talking about it on the broadcast, I'm planning on 2025. Like, everything I do right now is geared towards 2025 and getting looks at people. Now, if I were to go up to any one of those three starting pitchers and say, hey, we're going to claw you back a little bit, like shut you down a little bit or reduce your innings, I'm guessing that's going to get some fight back from each one of them. These are guys that have been around forever. They take a lot of pride in what they do. So that would be a tough one, but you have to get a look at some of these other arms, whether it's a Jake Bloss, if he comes up, whatever the case may be, you definitely have to get another look. I would, you know, like we've talked about this several times, but the way the Blue Jays built this starting rotation, I was the number one fan of it because I really believe it all begins on the mound with your starting pitcher. They built this rotation to be a contender year in and year out. Now, we know about this, quote, window, but these three guys, you look what they did last year and add Kikuchi into that. This route, they missed their spot. They missed their spot. And of course, we turned to the hitters. The lineup really brought that down, because if you look at last year, to me, that was your year to make a run with that rotation and that bullpen. Now, to expect them to do it all again this year, we all said it all winter long. That's a lot to ask for, and look what we're getting. It's just, it's another year. It's more miles on those arms, the bullpen and the injuries. That's another story. But for these guys, that window, I think, was last year, again, with Kikuchi there, to have four starters do what they did. And so now moving forward, my point being, it's just, it's a lot. It's a lot to ask those three guys to improve upon this year. They're all going to be a year older. It doesn't usually work that way. It's going to be tough, man. They got a lot of work to do here. And you can say, oh, they need to go out and get one more starter. And we can talk about Bowden Francis and Yariel Rodriguez all we want. But this rotation it's going to be a battle to be competitive enough to hand it over to a bullpen that has a lot of other holes that need to be filled, and hope that a lineup that has even more holes that need to be filled to score enough runs so that the pitching staff doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, it's you go from one area of the game to the other and to the other, and it's like, my goodness, it's not going
to
be easy.
No, it's tough. It's hard not to think we're going to look back at 2022 and 2023 and be like, man, you didn't take advantage of those pitching staffs. Like last year, they had four guys make 30 plus starts with reasonable year. Like, that just doesn't, I don't know if that's ever going to happen again. Four teams have two guys, like, or have four guys at 180 plus innings and things like that. So, that's a tough one. Joe, another thing I wanted to ask you about Gausman's start yesterday, that rally that started in the sixth, he gets the strikeout, but Alejandro Kirk allows the pass ball. It allows that first base runner, to reach. You know, I know the one knee down in two strike situations can be a little bit of controversial kind of mechanically. You know, I watched it back. Kirk's down on one knee there. It just seemed to get away from him. What did you see from Kirk in that spot?
He just missed it.
Yeah.
I mean, Alejandro Kirk's one of the best receivers in the game. One knee, two knees, no knees. I don't care how you're sitting. He just missed the baseball. But I think it's because mostly Kevin's splitters are going to dive arm side, right? They're going to go as a catcher to my left. So you're used to and expecting that movement to go glove side for you as a catcher to my left. And it looked like it either cut a little bit or just stayed out there. Like he pulled it. It wasn't the usual splitter that we see from Kevin Gausman, and it probably just caught Alejandro off guard. It's the worst feeling in the world. I think the camera showed Alejandro after that pitch. So I don't care what stance you're in. You just missed the baseball, and I think it's a little bit to do with the characteristics of that particular pitch. And who'd have thought the inning would go on the way it did? I mean, everybody has to be better. You got to get through it. Kevin's got to get the next guy. The bullpen has to come in and be better, but it's a tough one. I think Stevenson had the one that was initially a pass ball. It turned into a wild pitch, but it was a ball in the dirt. That was the one I have more of a problem with. And, you know, we could talk about one knee, two knee. It's a big conversation in baseball, but we also have seen that guys can block fine from one knee.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not as adamantly opposed to it. Where the only place I would go, Blake, and this is another conversation, but when things get tight and that tying runs on third or things, I just want a little bit more agility in case. Now, we all know most wild pitches in the dirt don't go 2 and 3 feet to my right or left. They're mostly right in front of you, and that's why the one knee works. And Alejandro's pretty good in that regard. But no, in this case, he just missed the ball, and I think it had a lot to do with a bit of an unusual splitter from Kevin.
Yeah, it's fascinating, the one knee stuff, where, like, obviously that hasn't been tracked historically. Like, so we assume most catchers were zero knees back in the past. And like data wise, it's like, well, it's definitely good for framing. We can say that for sure. Alejandro Kirk, mostly a one knee guy. That was only the seventh pass ball of his career. So obviously he's doing a pretty good job there. Generally, when it comes to Kirk, Joe, he has played in 14 of the last 15 games. He started 13 of those. What have you seen from him? You know, this is a big test for him with Danny Jansen not here anymore, playing a full-time, almost literally everyday workload.
Well, remember I just said that they had a lot of holes to fill?
Yeah.
There's one behind the plate as well, because Kirk's going to need a partner. The key is, what type of partner? Is it one to split times? I mean, Alejandro, is he going to catch maybe 80 games and 90 games, maybe 80, say, and then if he's hitting well and he's very effective at the plate, then he can DH another 30 plus. But he's got to be hitting. And now we're starting to see, you know, he kind of gets hot, cools off. And who knows if it has to do with playing time. It seems to, but it seems to be the more he plays, whether it's fatigue or whatever the case. When I say the word fatigue, it's more about, sometimes you don't even feel it or know it necessarily. But what you do is, when your body's not necessarily responding the way it should, and that might be in your stance, in the batter's box, and you move to the baseball, you start trying to do more. You start creating a little bit more, and that means a bigger move to the ball. It means your swing gets a little bit longer. I think those things can happen to Kirk like they do to almost every hitter in the world, but especially to him when he seems to log more work. So they're going to have to get somebody to at least catch half the games, I think. You know, is a Danny Jansen return in the, there's not a ton of great catching in Major League Baseball. I mean, it's that's why it's so important. And I mean, you can talk about every facet of the game. That's why the minor leagues and the farm system and drafting and developing and international signings and on and on and on is so critical, because when you don't have something coming up, you've got to go out and get it. You got to go out and sign a free agent. It's usually costly. You got to make a trade. You usually got to give up a player or two. That's costly in your assets. So, yeah, I don't know what they're going to do with him, but I think the biggest decision is, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to catch, not too many guys are going to catch over 100 games anymore, but especially Alejandro. And then if he's just an average type hitter or below average type hitter, not the guy we saw a couple of years ago, which we're seeing more and more of, then you're probably not going to DH 30 or 40 games either. So not sure where you're looking, but it's going to be costly.
Yeah, I think the most games started behind the plate this year is 98 so far, Logan Ohapi. So he's on, you know, he'll get, what, 120 here or something like that. And that's a young guy on a team that's not going anywhere and can afford to kind of, I mean, he's also had a pretty nice year. So, yeah, you're going to need another guy in there. You're going to get a call, Joe. You or Caleb will get a call at some point, given the catching market. Sticking with the catching theme, though, the other side of this game last night, what did you think of how they called the game for Julian Aguiar making his major league debut? Just kind of stick with, hey, the sinker's your bread and butter. Let's just ride that. Other than the one to Vlad there that he served up pretty nicely as a saucer for him. Did you like that kind of simplification of, look, man, short notice call up. Let's just pitch your bets, pitch as much as we can.
Yeah, I thought the slider to Vladdy, and I made a comment on the broadcast about it. It's the first one he threw. It's early in the ball game, and as a catcher, it doesn't matter who's on the mound, but especially with a young kid like that, big game, major league debut, you're just saying, get it out here, away. We'll try to get him chased, but you have that bad feeling. It's almost like that mulligan, but you're not allowed mulligans against Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Sure enough, he hung it. But I thought they did a good job, and David Bell had to be thrilled because you've got your all-star, and Hunter Green goes down to the IL. And, you know, they're still playing important games. They've been so hit and miss. They swept the Cardinals, and then they went ahead and got swept by the Royals. So they're hanging in there. A lot of teams in front of them in that wild card race. But let's say on the outside looking in for sure. But these are important games for them. And to call a kid up like that and to do what he did, like 4 innings, 2 runs, he just did exactly what you want in that situation, is keep my team in the game and give me a chance. And the Reds got a decent lineup. They got really shut down in Kansas City, but a lot of teams get shut down by their starting pitchers that they faced. So the kid kept them in the game. And yeah, I thought the sinker, I didn't know a lot about him. Kind of sniffed around and got some information about him. Sinker ball kind of guy that's going to get a lot of ground balls. And he used the sinker slider combo against the righties. And he mixed in that changeup against the lefties. He got a lot of key outs. I think he got Varsho, he got Horwitz, he got Barger all to kind of weakly ground to the right side. Even Varsho's RBI single was a changeup. He basically rolled over to the second baseman, but it found the hole and had eyes. So I thought he did a great job. I mean, for a young kid to do that, it was pretty cool. Always fun to watch a major league debut, you know. Not that you're on the side cheering for a kid, but it brings back memories for me and for anybody that played the game. That had to be a big moment and pretty special that he had a lot of family and friends there too. And they bought all the Reds gear. They must have bought everything in the Red shop there before the game. But a lot of fun to see for the kid and good for the Reds that he was able to do that and hand it off to the bullpen.
Yeah, speaking of the Joe Siddle debut, it wasn't intentional that I have the Expos hat beside me today, but it's there.
I love it.
It's there on the stage. Joe, before I let you go here, David Schneider came in as a pinch hitter last night. He's obviously been going through it. He goes 0 for 2 with 2 strikeouts and gets absolutely jobbed in that one plate appearance. 2 really bad called strikes there. What have you seen from where Davis is? And man, does it just feel like that sometimes when you're in a spot like he is to get, you know, I know you guys talked about it on the broadcast, but that was 2 pretty, pretty rough calls to have in the same plate appearance.
Yeah, regardless of a young player, older player, veteran, everybody goes through slumps, even Vladdy. I mean, guys go through rough stretches, but it seems like when you're going through rough stretches, you're not getting a ton of pitches to hit. Calls are going against you. The world is against you. I really felt bad for Davis last night. I mean, he has really been going through it. We know how he came on the scene last year and things have been going south since. This is still a guy that if he figures something out a little bit, he's still a dangerous bat, maybe even just a hit against left-handed pitch. And I certainly wouldn't count him out just yet, despite what you've been seeing. But I really feel like he's pulling off the baseball. And I know he's a pull guy, tries to get the ball in the air. But at the major league level, now he's been around enough that teams are onto that. And he is getting pounded away and away some more, it seems like. And they're just forcing him to stay on the ball longer. And hasn't made the adjustment yet. And I've always said, when you burst on the scene, you can kind of catch them, not go unnoticed, but you can sneak up on them. But now the league knows how his profile and his swing path, and he's got to make the adjustment. If not, he's not going to survive. But I think he's very capable of it. But it just seems like every swing he takes, he's just leaking off the ball enough that anything middle of the way. You know, I've seen it with other guys too. Even like Barger does it a little bit for me from the left side. It's that ball middle in, you can kind of square up and do some damage, but as soon as it gets away, it's tough to do a whole lot with. So he's got to make an adjustment. He's got a little bit of time left this year, and if he's still around spring training, but you got to figure it out. Otherwise, those are the players that don't quite last very long in the big league.
Yeah, and it could be a case here where, I mean, it's looked lately like, yeah, he'll start against lefties, but with how many lefties they have competing for these spots, you know, playing time's going to be tough a little bit there. We'll see. Will Wagner's going to go through this in a couple weeks here as well if he keeps this up. Horwitz has gone through it. So, yeah, it'll be fun to see how these guys definitely fun to see. By the time 2025 rolls around, hopefully we're not still in figure it out mode, but that's what the rest of the way here is about, right?
Well, I talk about all these young kids, and this is kind of tryout camp. They're all getting their look right now, and this is great. We all want to see this. John Schneider wants to see it. The Blue Jays want to see it. But, I mean, let's not pretend that these – many of these guys are going to be everyday regulars. I mean, you're going to need to see an awful lot from a Joey Loperfido to give him the left field job next year, or for Horwitz even at second base. I'm sure he's a little further ahead than others. But you got Schneider and Barge. I mean, the list goes on. Leo Jimenez, we've seen a lot. But, I mean, if I'm a betting man, I'm not seeing a lot of those guys as everyday players for the Blue Jays next year on a team that we understand is trying to contend. I think they got to go out and make some moves for sure. Any and all of those players at some point next year can certainly be contributors, but I think if they're contributors in the bottom half of the lineup, if like a Dalton Varsho, who's batting second all the time now, if he is down batting sixth or seventh, I mean, now to me with some boppers up in the top half, now you've got a lineup that can compete. So I wouldn't count on these young kids that we're looking at to be the everyday guys, but at the same time, you can't have $20 million players all over the field. So they'll have to contribute at times as well.
Yeah, like you and I talked about off air before Blue Jays Central on the weekend, they've got the makings of a really good bench for next year. But if all four of those bench guys are starting, you're probably repeating what this year has looked like. Joe, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. I hope you get a little more sunshine in before you dip back down at the park.
All right, Blake. Have a great one. Thanks, man.
Joe Siddle of Sportsnet on the call with Dan Schulman for the remainder of this series. It continues at 7:07 tonight. It's Jose Barrios against Carson Spires, who is an interesting Bowden Francis slash Ross Stripling-ish type of guy in that he has been up and down between the majors and AAA for a couple years. He has been bouncing starter to reliever for a couple years. Actually, this is the Reds' entire rotation now. Nick Martinez, who's going to start tomorrow, has an entire career as being a swingman as well, and is just like lights out lately. If you are a fantasy player at all and you do the streaming starting pitching game, you are very familiar with how Nick Martinez has looked the last few weeks. We'll get into Carson Spires a little bit more. We'll set you up for that game. We'll take some texts in the text line today as well. You can text us at 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. We got a couple left over from yesterday, so if you sent one in yesterday, I've still got them here. We'll get to them at some point. There was I do want to answer one from last week that I didn't, just because we have a minute here before the break. John from Toronto had asked, any comparison between this year's Blue Jays and last year's Yankees? If the Yankees could turn it around by bringing in one main support piece for their best player, why couldn't the Jays do the same for next season? If the support piece is Juan Soto, one of the 10 best hitters like in the history of baseball, yes, I think the Blue Jays could turn it around with one support piece. As things stand, though, the Jays don't have a top shortstop prospect coming up. They don't have, I mean, I know the alien hasn't played much this year, but another prospect like that and Jason Dominguez and a prospect like the Yankees farm system was stronger than the Blue Jays is right now. And that's why they were able to trade for Juan Soto and the Blue Jays were not able to trade for Juan Soto. Calling Juan Soto a main support piece is really underselling the fact that, yeah, if Juan Soto were not literally teammates with Aaron Judge, he would probably be Aaron Judge's main competition for the most valuable player award. Yes, if the Jays add Juan Soto, I like their chances of turning it around. And in fact, I like their chances of doing that so much that I think they should go out and sign Juan Soto. I think that would be a great, great offseason move. Let's take a break. When we come back on the other side, we'll talk to C. Trent Rosecrans of The Athletic. We'll get to know this Reds team a little bit more. Ellie De La Cruz's chase for the 2060 mark, the severity of Hunter Green's injury and what that could possibly do for their chase to the wild card here. The Reds, after winning last night, are, I was going to say only, they're 5.5 back of the third wild card spot in the NL. They're an interesting team because based on playoff odds and the amount of ground they have to make up here, they're on life support here. However, they have the Jays right now, and then they have Pittsburgh and Oakland coming up after this. They have a window here to make a bit of a run. They also have like by far the best run differential of any team that's not in a playoff spot right now. So when you're looking at how good is this team actually, how good should their record be? Yes, they lost Hunter Green. Their rotation's been thinned out, but they've played better than a 61-64 team so far this year. So they'll be interesting to watch, especially this series and over the next week or so with Pittsburgh and Oakland. Let's take a break. Let's get to know them a little more with C. Trent on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's Hard to Love by Bully. This Jays team, a little hard to love this year. The Reds' playoff chances, a little hard to love right now. 5.5 out. Fangraphs has them at 2% playoff odds. But they've got two more against the Jays. They got the Pirates. They got the Athletics. Let's check in and see how those playoff chances look with C. Trent Rosecrans of The Athletic, one of the absolute best beat writers in the entire business. C. Trent, thank you for doing this, man. How are we doing?
Great. Bully, man. That was one of my favorite albums of last year. Just such, like, start to finish. Just a beautiful album. So, like, really, you kind of threw me off my game because that is very good and so much different. Yet another reason I love Canada.
Yeah. There we go. One of my favorite albums of 2023 as well, and can't recommend her enough. If you get a chance to see her live, if she goes through the Cincinnati or Louisville area at all,
I saw her. I guess it was the same day as the eclipse, and we went to Athens, Ohio, and it was her and Craig Finn both just did solo things. She did half with the guitar and half with the piano, and it was just fantastic.
That sounds unbelievable. That sounds like a great time. Also a great time if the Reds make the playoffs here. Man, how are we feeling about it? So they come off that big sweep, then they get swept. Now they've got this 10-game window with pretty weak competition. Obviously, the Pirates have really come back down to earth. That's sandwiched with the Jays and the Athletics. 5.5 out here, and Fangraphs has them at 2% playoff odds. How are you feeling about how that looks, how the urgency level is right now?
You know, I don't think it's as much about who they play as how they play. And I'm kind of a believer in that in baseball is in general, but, you know, if you look too much at who's on the schedule and what their overall record is, that means you're not playing well. Because when you're playing well, you don't care who's on the schedule. If you're playing well, it's always going to be who's next, and it doesn't matter. And right now, I think the fact that we're looking at who they're playing tells you how they're playing.
That's a good way to put it. And I was reflecting yesterday. John Schneider got asked, like, was there a time in this season where, like, they broke your heart or something like that? And he was like, profanity was like, no. But then we got into, like, was there a series? Was there a moment? And I was thinking back, the Jays had a 13-game stretch where it's like White Sox, Tigers, Pirates, White Sox or something like that. And in retrospect, the fact that for 2 months we were like, just get to that 13-game stretch, just get to that 13-game stretch, was a red flag. The Reds are also going to have a little extra trouble with this because they're going to navigate these next couple weeks without Hunter Green. He hit the IL the other day. It doesn't sound like anyone's like crazy worried about the long-term impact here. But what does this look like kind of medium term here? And does how they do over the next couple weeks impact what the plan would be in terms of bringing him back and the speed with which they do that?
No, I think when Hunter is ready, he's going to be back, and it's not going to depend on where they are in the standings or anything. And a big part of that is you know, he's having just a great season. And this is his third season, and pitching most of a season would be a huge hurdle for him. I think that's something that he wants to do to test himself to pitch in September. He pitched in September last year, but he missed 2 months before that to make this a true 15-day IL stint and then come back, I think would be huge for him just mentally, just to say, hey, I've done it. And then you could also kind of piggyback and look at that and maybe he is a, you know, Cy Young candidate. He is certainly in the discussion for that award right now. And I think it's important for him as much as anything, just to get back, feel healthy, feel good, end on a positive note, individually at least.
So when we look at his season, injury aside, obviously 143 innings, the most he's already thrown at the majors. Strikeout rate hasn't changed a ton. Walk rate, ground ball rate, chase rate, none of that stuff's changed a ton. He's just gotten way better. The ERA's dropped 2 full runs. He told you, I've made up my mind on being one being an ace. What has that looked like? What is, you know, when we dive in a little further here, what's gone into, hey, the underlying stuff's the same, but this guy's just learned how to pitch at an ace level?
Well, and I think there's some more deception on the fastball. You know, you looked at it and the fastball's always had that velocity, but then look at the hard hit rate on that fastball. And this year, guys just aren't seeing it and they're not hitting it. They used to be able to square it up really easily, and now they're having a harder time. And a lot of that comes with deception. A lot of it comes with having to honor the other pitches. His slider has always been very good, but he's kind of using it better. And that third pitch has been elusive, and he hasn't used it a whole lot, but that splitter is something you can really dream on. And when it's good, it's really good. And it doesn't need to be something that he throws 20 times a game. If he can get it 10 times a game and five of those be really good, that is enough to help the other two pitches, especially that fastball.
Yeah, when your third pitch is your worst pitch and it has an expected slug against it of 244, I'm going to dream on the potential of that pitch to scale a little bit. Okay, so with him out, we saw Julian Aguiar make his debut last night, rush around, try to find a passport and things like that. He was the Fangraphs had him in their midseason update as the number 7 prospect in the Reds organization, and I know he won minor league pitcher of the year in that organization last year. Do you think he takes the spot for a little bit here, or are we headed for the churn so they have an extra bullpen arm and things like that?
Right now they don't really have that bullpen arm. They're waiting for some of that. They don't really have a long guy because they had a long guy, and then they traded Frankie Montas and they moved Nick Martinez into the rotation. He's been very good. The thing is that really hurt the guys that they can use for length. Brent Suter has been out. He should be back here pretty soon, and he's a guy that they want to be able to use multiple innings. So, I think it's just figuring it out for these next 2 weeks and hoping that's all it is. But a guy like Aguiar, he was going to have to be protected after the season anyway. He's done everything you've asked to do. He pitched really well to start the season at Chattanooga, got put up to AAA, struggled a little bit, and then kind of figured it out. And it's a guy, it's kind of that natural progression. And he's kind of like tonight's pitchers, Carson Spires. There are guys that they like, the back of the rotation type guys that they think can just be good, solid starters. And good, solid starters are not a common thing. It's something that everybody has to have. If you have a Hunter Green at the front, if you have a Nick Lodolo when he's pitching really well, which he is not right now, you can do those. You feel pretty good about filling in, especially, with another guy like Andrew Rabbit. They've got some pitchers. What they didn't want to do is go for someone who's not quite ready, and that would have been Rhett Lauder, one of their top prospects, the number one, their first round pick last year out of Wake Forest. And he's kind of doing that thing where he got up to Double A this year, struggled early, and is really finding his footing now. It's his first year of pro ball. He didn't pitch at all last year in pro ball. So those are guys that they want to bring on more slowly. They don't need to put them on the 40 man yet. So Julian Aguiar is a guy that is kind of fitting right in and is a guy that they think they like a lot and think that has some potential to be a back of the rotation type guy for several years.
You mentioned Carson Spires will go tonight. Similar to Nick Martinez, bouncing around reliever, starter, bulk guy, whatever you want to call it. He's been in a couple different roles. I know he got rocked in his last start and then came out of the bullpen after that. But what are you looking for from Spires? I know the stuff doesn't blow anyone away, but three different fastballs in there with the sweeper. Just a tough guy to figure out. Is that kind of the read on him?
Yeah, and he's a guy that knows how to pitch. There's sometimes you always see it, the guys with the big stuff learn how to pitch, and then the guys who don't have those biggest stuff get here because they know how to pitch, and that's how Carson Spires got here. And he's a good competitor. They've used an opener a couple times with him, and they've used the opener with pretty good success throughout this year, but I think with that short bullpen, especially last night, Aguiar coming in on short notice to really make his big league debut, they need some length from Spires, and that's what they're hoping for is length just to save that bullpen, because that bullpen was beat up against Kansas City. They had that sweep of the Cardinals and then got swept by Kansas City, and as bad as the Cardinals looked when they were here, the Reds looked worse when the Royals were here. But So it was a litmus test, and they failed.
Okay, I want to ask you about Ellie De La Cruz now, which I'm sure you've gotten asked so much about him. Yeah, I broke down his base stealing last night on our pregame, and it was like, yeah, here's a shocker. He really, really fast, like real fast, especially when he hits from the left side and he's the quickest in the league to first base. But he's been sitting on 59 stolen bases here for 10 games. When are we getting number 60?
When he gets on with somebody not in front of him, you know. He is electric. It was funny. 2 years ago, I was just looking ahead how on your phone when it pops up. 2 years ago, here you are. I was in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Rocket City Trash Pandas, and I sat on a Chattanooga Lookouts full six game series. And I just remember coming back from that series like, am I overhyping this guy? Am I overselling him? And it turns out I was underselling him, which was I thought was impossible. He is just phenomenal. And what is interesting is who we just kind of going back to seeing the Cardinals and the Royals, see a guy in Mason Wynn for the Cardinals, a young shortstop, has a really good start, had some struggles, kind of figuring out that first year. Well, Ellie De La Cruz did that last year. Then Bobby Witt Jr. comes in, and that is a guy who took a really big step forward in his second year, which Ellie De La Cruz has been able to do. And then this third year is arguably the best player in baseball. I think you can make that argument pretty easily right now. And that is kind of where the Reds are hoping that he follows that Bobby Witt Jr. Trajectory. And the thing that I think, you know, we get caught up with all the measurables about Ellie De La Cruz. And there's a ton of, you know, start with his height. You know, he's 6'5", 6'4", 6'6". I'm not even sure. What his real height is, but then you go to, okay, he hits the ball as hard as anybody, he throws the ball as hard as anybody, and he runs faster than anybody. I think, you know, if you go back to Sunday's game, there was a play where they had runners on second and third, the Royals, and a ball hit kind of in the gap between the third baseman and the shortstop. Ellie cuts it off early and tags out the runner at third base who had kind of meandered off the bag looking to try to maybe score after the throw to first. But instead of throwing to first, Ellie tagged him at third. And it's just one of those heads up plays that Ellie De La Cruz is a really smart, instinctive baseball player. And for all the tools that we talk about, I think people don't talk enough about his intelligence, his feel for the game, and his competitiveness. I think that is a really underrated part of his game just because all the other lights are so shiny and bright that you can forget about those that you almost take for granted. And so he's a joy to watch every day. And that's been fun.
He's also got the cool thing on defense. It's like the anti-Jeter where he leads the league in errors because he just gets the balls and tries to make plays on things that nobody else would even sniff. It's pretty remarkable.
And then you look at all the advanced statistics, and for the most part, they rate him as one of the best ones. And I think he's going to, over the years, look at Bobby Witt Jr. You know, Bobby Witt Jr., his first year, he was rated really poor defensively. Last year, pretty darn good. And then this year, as good as anybody. Again, I know I keep going back to Bobby Witt Jr., but I just saw him. And he is
also like, he's like, you know, 1-2 in the MVP voting. Pretty good comp if you're a good young shortstop right now.
Like, that's what you want. But like, you know, Ellie De La Cruz, if you look, he's got an MVP case.
Yeah.
And so I think that is what they're hoping, that he can then take that to that next level, like Witt. And it's been really interesting. And I think he's going to shore up a lot of those defensive errors. I don't get too worked up on errors just because they are they're subjective. I mean, how many times have we complained about in the last couple of years about the scoring calls? Well, those are errors.
Yeah.
That's where those errors come from. And a lot of the reason he has a lot of the errors, not all of them, but many of them are, like you said, that he gets to balls that nobody else would get and makes them close and they become errors. Whereas other shortstops just might watch the left fielder, field the ball.
Yeah, or eat it if you don't have a throw or whatever, because you don't throw 95 miles an hour going over your back shoulder. Okay, so from a future MVP to a former MVP, I know you're not covering him now, but some of us thought when we looked at the schedule before the season, maybe Joey Votto will be here for this series. He's not. He hasn't played particularly well at AAA. It doesn't sound like he feels ready yet. I know you have had a longstanding relationship with Votto, covering the Reds and talking to him a ton over the years in your work at The Athletic. What's your read from afar on how this year's gone for him? And would we have met in person had Joey Votto gotten the call up this week?
Probably, yeah. and like I would have, I mean, heck, even if they didn't send me, I'd want to see that just to see, you know, Joey Votto. I remember, you know, the first time I met Joey Votto was at the Futures game in, I think, 2006, was it in Pittsburgh? And when I was Homer Bailey was the big draw for the Reds at that Futures game. And I was like, oh, I'll go talk to the kid on the world team, the Canadian kid. And I met this polite young man. And then I talked to him a little bit more that next spring in 07. And then he became this generational, this Hall of Famer, who I would say, and I would get pushback in this town, but the greatest hitter in Reds history.
Which is, there is a debate to be had there. And there's a debate here of, is he the greatest hitter in Canadian baseball history when you've got, you know, a Larry Walker, then you get into the Coors Field of it all. But yeah, I mean, I think
don't get me started on Larry Walker. I was the biggest proponent of Larry Walker in the Hall of Fame for many, many years. Yeah. I love Larry Walker. I think he's a phenomenal player. He was a five-tool player. But I think Larry Walker is probably a better player than Joey Votto, maybe, but Joey Votto is a better hitter.
Yeah, that which is fair when you're first base slash DH. Knowing Votto as you do, I would imagine there's not a ton of surprise for you that he's not up yet, given the injuries and given that he's not hitting well yet, right? Like given how you know him, like he probably wouldn't want to be here until he was ready to compete, right?
He wants Joey Votto's biggest competition is himself. And the numbers won't tell you if he thinks he's right, but he will tell you if he thinks he's right and if he was ready. And I don't think he wants to step on a major league field in a major league uniform, especially that uniform. I don't believe he would do it if he didn't believe that he could be a productive member of the team. That's just not Joey. Joey marches to his own drummer. Whatever cliche you want to throw in there, he is his own person. And he is a unique person, but he is also extremely self-aware and would know whether he could perform at that level. And I don't think at this point he feels that way. And so there are people who probably don't have the history with him as much that were speculating, well, this is just too perfect. And it's like, that is not. That is the antithesis of what Joey Votto does. Joey is a consummate professional when it comes to baseball. And I'm lucky in my career that I've been able to watch his entire professional or at least major league career.
Well, and look, it's led to a ton of great articles over the years as well. So appreciate all the great work chronicling that and chronicling the Reds in general. C. Trent, thanks for joining us this morning, man. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. Really enjoyed it.
C. Trent Rosecrans of The Athletic. Again, a lot of great stuff historically with Votto, a lot of great stuff on this current Reds team who, a little bit of life support here for their playoff chances. And they got to stack some wins here. They have a lot on the line in this series against the Jays. And I mentioned they got the Pirates and The Athletics coming up. And you don't want a schedule watch, but this time of year, if you are on the fringes of the playoff race and trying to figure out if you're still in it or not, it doesn't hurt to have, as weird as this is to say, given where we started this season, doesn't hurt to have the Jays on the schedule. Certainly doesn't hurt to have the Athletics on the schedule. We have Mike Petriello and Shai Davidi on the schedule for the second hour here. We'll also take some more of your texts to 590, 590. So send them in. Standard data and message rates may apply. Sign them. Let us know where you're from so we can shout you out. And please make sure you know you're texting to me. There's one in the text line right now that is attributing something to me that I have never said. So we'll see. We'll sprinkle some of those in. Mike Petriello joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lose last night. Their last win came Sunday, and it came in a tremendous performance from Bowden Francis, who our next guest has been tracking pretty closely as he adds a splitter, as he adds a sinker. Can he establish himself as a starter? We're going to go all over the place here in talking to Mike Petriello of MLB.com. Mike, good morning, man. How are we doing?
Hey, Blake. I'm doing great. What's going on?
Not much, just doing the show, you know, 57 hours left in the season here of Jays Talk Plus, so not counting them down or anything. Bowden Francis, American League Player of the Week. He's someone you and I had touched on a little bit before. I know you've tweeted out, hey, look at the pitch mix. This is interesting. What have you seen of late since we last talked to you, last tweeted about it? Another really good start from him over the weekend.
Yeah, he's been really interesting. I'm always fascinated when you have a guy who's kind of struggled to find some success in the majors and then goes and makes a whole bunch of changes and finds success, right? And I read a really good article a couple months ago. I can't remember who wrote it. Someone said that maybe Chris Bassett taught him a better grip on his off-speed pitch. It must have been a really impressive writer. I don't remember who came up with that. And it's worked, right? Like, you look at Francis last year, and he threw his curveball about a third of the time, right? It was a decent enough pitch. It was one of only three pitches he threw. And this year, the curves allowed a slugging of over 600, lost some spin on it. Movement's been down about an inch in both directions. And it was getting plastered, right? And it just wasn't working. So now he goes back and he works on the splitter and he adds a bit of a sinker. And suddenly he's a completely different guy. And I don't know that I would look at either of those pitches and say, oh, wow, this is the world's greatest splitter. Like, he's not actually getting a ton of swing and miss on it or anything like that. But you can see in the results that he has gone from a guy who you probably wouldn't trust in a rotation to someone that I'm kind of interested in seeing if maybe he can be part of next year's rotation, because as I don't need to tell you or anybody listening, the remainder of this season is entirely about what do we have on next year's roster. And it's pretty clear that needing a couple extra starting pitchers is going to be high on that list. And maybe Francis can be one of those guys.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, like you mentioned, the splitter doesn't have crazy swing and miss, but he's confident throwing it around the zone. And it's got a major ground ball right on it that mostly guys are just beating it in the ground. He actually hasn't allowed an extra base hit on it yet in 160 of those thrown. So it'd be interesting to see how he continues to layer that on. What are you looking for other than just the splitter the rest of the way? Like, I don't think Bowden Francis could probably go like perfect game every game the rest of the way, and then he'd have a for sure rotation spot for next year. But given the amount of holes the Blue Jays had and how much their starting pitching depth has been thin the last couple of years, what do you think he needs to show to, you know, have the leg up on that spring training bat? I guess what I'm trying to say is I think that the road to locking down a spot for sure would be very, very arduous from here, even with a good close to the season. But what are you looking for if you're going to have him in the mix for that SP4, SP5 next year?
Yeah, I mean, what's the 25 Jays rotation right now, right? It's Bassett, Berríos, Gausman. Tiedemann's probably out of the picture. Manoah's not in the picture. Yariel Rodriguez, maybe, right?
Jake Bloss in the mix there somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. And listen, as much as I like Gausman and Bassett, they're not young in pitcher years. As much as I like Jose Berríos, he has struggled for a couple of months, right? Those guys will have jobs. Obviously, they will be the big three, barring any unexpected moves. But they're going to have to go out and get at least one starting pitcher. But when you look at the way starting rotations work these days, that's very rare to pencil in five guys and say, these are my five guys for 32 starts, right? I think that's part of the downfall of this year's Jays team, is maybe there was a bit too much confidence in that happening. That didn't happen. So whether or not he is in the opening day rotation and gets his 32 starts, I think he just has to pitch competently for the rest of the year and show that this new pitch mix is something you can work on, maybe figure out what happened with that curveball, get that pitch back over the winter. And he's in the mix for, you know, it starts don't even matter that much, right? Is it 100 innings? Is it 150 innings? As long as they are solid innings, you just got to get to that goal of covering innings. I'm a little less worried about whether it's 20 starts, 30 starts.
Yeah, which is, fair, and he won't have options, so he'll be in the mix somewhere. Him and Yariel both, actually. Yariel, because of the terms of the contract he signed in the offseason, won't be optionable next year. So those guys are going to have roles somewhere, but it's, you know, there's a big difference between you're the fourth starter and you're the two inning guy out of the bullpen, or in Yariel's case, you're the eighth inning guy or something like that. A lot still to happen. So that'll be fun to track with it with Bowden Francis. Believe his next start comes against the Angels again, which not a bad landing spot, not a bad. Hey, he did two decent ones in a row against the Orioles, so I don't want to make it seem like it's just quality competition, but not a bad team to try to stack another one against that Angels team. Want to go outside the Jays here. Want to do some early-ish awards talk with you. You wrote a great thing about Chris Sale, and some of it had to do with the Cy Young race. He somehow never won one, despite, in my head, he's like, you know, one of the best pitchers of this generation. Where are you at on where Chris Sale is? And before we get into the specifics of, you know, how rare what he's doing is, how that Cy Young race shapes up the way it looks right this second.
It looks to me like it's a slam dunk. And I know that there's other names there you could argue for, Logan Webb, right? Zach Wheeler. I would have said Hunter Green before he got injured. Now I think maybe that sets him behind. It's not been necessarily a great year for starting pitching in the National League, because obviously Spencer Strider, you thought maybe he'd be a front runner, and he got injured really quickly. And the way I look at it now, the only way that Chris Sale is not going to win this convincingly, setting aside an injury, right, which could always happen, is if he has such a huge innings gap behind Logan Webb that there are voters who really want to reward that durability more than the dominance. But I'm not really seeing that happening right now. Like, someone tried to come at me with this about Zach Wheeler the other day. And I'm like, there's like a 9 innings gap here.
Yeah.
This is not that big of a deal. Logan Webb, I think, is up by like 20 or something. And he's 24. Really good. 24, exactly. But if you look at what Chris Sale has done this year, he is pretty much pitching like peak Chris Sale. Like, you look at the way the pitches move, you look at the underlying numbers, and it's like, oh yeah, this is what happened in 2016, 17, 18. Like, that's the guy you thought you would never, ever see again. And that's why when I wrote about him, I didn't even dive that deeply into like what the pitches looked like what his strategy was, because it's just like, oh yeah, we've seen this guy. That's the guy. Him being back now is incredible. And for all of the cursed results of the 2024 Braves season, and there have been many, including as recently as yesterday with Austin yes. Riley getting hurt, Chris Sale's going to win the Cy Young. I would almost guarantee it.
Yeah, and they, by the way, the Braves signed Gio Urshela today right to the major leagues because Austin Riley's going on the IL, which I don't know. There's not a max to how many guys you could put on the IL, but if there was, they'd be there. it's been a rough one. So with Chris Sale, I mentioned it. He's come top four in Cy Young award voting 4 different times, from 2012 when he became a full-time starter to 2018 when things started to unravel a little bit. You know, he was constantly in the 2 to low 3 ERA range. And then he had 4 seasons where he was either less effective or injured or both. Him getting this back at 35, I mean, how you dove in, how unprecedented is it, not even just to come back, but to even, hey, have been this good at 23, 24 and still this good at 35, let alone be out of it for like 4 years.
Yeah, the shape of his career is fantastic. So I looked at it in 2 ways, right? First, I wanted to see pitchers, and all of this is going to be post-World War II. I didn't go back to the olden times here, who had a great season, which I defined as 5 wins above replacement, both before age 25 and after age 35. And there's only 10 of those guys, but a lot of them don't count because they were just good the entire time, right? David Cone was always good. Roger Clemens was pretty much always good. Not what we're going for here. So what I tried to do was find someone who was truly elite in their 20s and into their age 30 season, which by any definition, Chris Sale qualifies for that, and then offered essentially nothing for the next 4 years, as you defined. He pitched a little bit, but you know, nothing that impressive, and then had at least one more really, truly great season at age 35 and beyond. And I only found one real comparable, and I don't think a lot of people remember his name, which is kind of a shame. And that's Rick Rushel, who pitched for the Giants and Cubs back in the 70s and 80s. Kind of the same deal. Injured his shoulder, missed a bunch of time, had 2 team doctors tell him, you will never pitch again. And he did a whole bunch of rehab, came back, and finished 3rd in the Cy Young in like his age 38 season or whatever. And I can tell you, when I wrote about this, I was happy because I thought it was a cool story. Like, wow, look at Chris Sale. But I also tweeted like, hey, I'm thinking deeply about Rick Rushel. And you know who liked that tweet? His daughter, which I appreciated. I liked that a lot. And I hope she got word to Rick, hey, people are talking to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's cool. And yeah, I mean, he kind of did it twice, right? Like, he had the comeback year and then another 5 win season. So I guess with respect to Chris Sale, are we like, do we lock in kind of that? Yeah, Chris Sale's back. And I guess like at a certain point, there's obviously a huge load factor to trying to work your way back from injury. But also when we talk about him being 35, he didn't pitch a lot the last 3 years. Like, maybe he can sustain a little bit. I don't know. Where are you on, like, what Chris Sale looks like moving forward? Because he's a free agent. He's going to be in the, you know, near the very top of the free agent pitching market.
Yeah, is this the start of an incredible second act, right? Like, the part I feel confidence in here is that this isn't like some late career Jamie Moyer type where he's getting by on guts and guile, right? Like, the pitches look great. Like, he looks like he ever did. And I do get your point about not having maybe as much mileage as you'd think for all the years he didn't pitch. Although, you know, part of that was a Tommy John, right? Yeah. He had multiple arm injuries. I think I remember he had some fluke stuff, like he broke a bone on a bike or something like that. It was just not a good run for him at all. So I do think that you look at the performance here and you say, this is not a once in a lifetime thing. This is like the seventh different time that Chris Sale has had a season this good. He is a Hall of Fame caliber pitcher. I actually think he's got a very good shot of getting there someday, especially if he gets that Cy this year. So he's still going to be 36. I'm still not looking for a 5-year deal or anything like that. But he is going to be well positioned, I think, to get one of those short term, very high average annual value deals. And there's going to be a lot of teams interested in that.
Yeah, so that's Chris Sale at 25 and 35. There's also, we're now going to get Rich Hill doing it at having one win seasons at 25, 35, and 45 now that he's back, which is fun. We could do the American League Cy Young. It's like Tarik Skubal's got a decent lead there. So let's pivot to the MVP race because you started tweeting some stuff that I have a feeling the article is coming at some point. When you look at, do you have an actual vote, by the way?
I am eligible for a vote, but okay. I have never received one because the New York chapter of the Writers Association is massive and they only pick two per vote. So no, I never get one. People in smaller chapters get one every year.
Okay. All right. Well, we just had C. Trent on. We know he's definitely got one in Cincinnati then. Okay. So you don't have a vote, but if you were to have a vote, when you're looking at these things, wins above replacement is obviously not everything, right? It's an approximation, and we see it on the Fangraphs or Baseball Reference leaderboard to one decimal point. How careful do we need to be using wins above replacement? Like, as anything more than like, well, this is how I'm going to do my initial sort, and then I'll start looking at stuff.
It's extremely important. Listen, if you just do your vote based on ranking the wins above replacement, that's a mistake, right? It's not
we don't need
perfect,
voters then.
If we're exactly right. But I'll leave you this. If you try to do a vote without looking at this metric, then you're doing yourself a disservice as well, right? Is it perfect? Is it flawless? Absolutely not. Is it the best thing we have? Does it correlate pretty well to the winners? Sure. Dan Szymborski of Fangraphs wrote about this recently, and I thought it was really interesting. He looked at all the voting through the year 2000. And it's like, it didn't correlate that well to wins above replacement, understandably, because they didn't have it handy and other things were more important at the time. But since 2000, it correlates very well to the eventual winners. But you do have to be careful about it because, as you said, decimal points don't matter that much. Like, I see people right now saying, oh, you know, Francisco Lindor has a 5.8 and Otani's got a 5.7. Lindor is in the lead. And it's like, no, they're tied. They're tied. I'm sorry. Like, anything within a half a win, I would say there's a margin of error here. Like, you could go to Fangraphs and download it to like 9 decimal points. I absolutely pray you don't do that. Don't put meaning to it. Please don't, but you can. It's a best estimate. Obviously there's differences in, you know, defensive metrics and all that kind of stuff, but I'm fine to look at this as a starting point and say, well, Bobby Witt Jr. and Aaron Judge are basically tied, right? Lindor and Otani are tied. So I feel confident that I can make a good case for either one of those guys. Now, I know a lot of people are going to be listening and say, Aaron Judge is like the Babe Ruth of the current day, and that's all they care about, and that's totally fine. I don't think it's a problem to say, yeah, but Bobby Witt's going to win the Gold Glove playing shortstop, and he's doing everything he's doing, right? Like, you can't just ignore part of the game because you don't like wins above replacement. Like, defense matters a lot. What Bobby Witt Jr. is doing on the bases matters a lot. And some voters will actually care about the fact that the Royals have come back from the dead to be in the playoff race. I don't personally care about that in this. It's not a team award for me. But the fact is, WAR has to be included in any evaluation. It just can't be the only thing you look at.
The other fascinating part with Witt and Judge too, right, is like this is not quite Miguel Cabrera against Mike Trout. When Miguel Cabrera won it with the Triple Crown, Mike Trout had more wins above replacement. And both of those guys had like MVP caliber seasons. But it became like, where is the party line, like analytics versus traditional. This is like, First of all, Aaron Judge is like lapping the league in homers and RBIs. But he's also like, these are the two guys also competing for the batting title. Bobby Witt Jr. it leads the league in batting average and Aaron Judge is second. So like, even if you're an old school person, like you're going to want to keep an eye on this, but yes, the defense and the base running there is, you know, what are we talking about? 64 points of on base and almost 90 points of slug, but we're talking about the difference of like almost 2.5 estimated wins just for the defensive value of going from an okay outfielder to the best shortstop. And then you mentioned the base running as well. He's got 25 stolen bases too. It's crazy close.
That should all matter. And you know what's going to happen? I can tell you exactly how this is going to go, right? I'm going to sit here and tweet, and I already have. This is a really close race. Wins above replacement are similar. You can make a really good case for either one. And what's going to happen is Aaron Judge is going to win it unanimously. And the reason for that is it's a binary vote, right? All you do is you say yes or no. You don't get to say, well, I'm going to pick Aaron Judge, but by a margin of 52 to 48 or by a margin of 92 to 8. You pick one guy or you don't. And so that ending vote total doesn't really tell you that much about how close it is, because all that matters is first place votes. But I'm telling you, you could make a great case for either one, and I'd be perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, we ran into this in the NBA this year where like Jokic got 79 of the 100 MVP votes and Shea got 15 and Doncic got 4. And maybe it wasn't this year, maybe it was the year prior, but it was people were upset that like it wasn't close enough. But to try to explain to people, it's like, I don't have a vote, but if I did, I don't get to say Jokic by 10%. It's Jokic, period. And then Embiid number two, if it was 2 years ago, or Shea number two last year, whatever it was. You don't get to draw the granularity there. It's just straight up. So that's the American League side. The National League side kind of mirrors this a little bit, right? Like Shohei has the most home runs. He's got a shot at the Triple Crown there. Couldn't believe Marcell Ozuna's batting average when I looked at the Triple Crown leaders, by the way. Marcell Ozuna might win the Triple Crown too. And then Lindor kind of has, a little more defensive juice. They're a little closer on base running because Shohei's obviously stealing some bases too. What do you make of the National League side of this?
Yeah, it's a little different just because Witt and Judge are having both what I might consider all-time historic seasons.
10-win seasons,
I don't
maybe.
Yeah, I don't consider that to be true in the NL. Yes, I guess if they win a Triple Crown, you might view it that way. But, you know, setting that aside, it's not been a great year for star power in the National League, especially in the outfield. Ohtani's going to win, especially, listen, if he goes 40-40 and puts up all these numbers, he's going to be the first DH to ever win. And I think that's fine because Ketel Marte is in the mix. He just got injured. I was actually listening to part of your conversation with C. Trent, who I love, and you got into a little bit about the Ellie De La Cruz defense situation, where it's like the defensive metrics like him, but he has a billion errors. That's going to hurt him with some voters. Like it or not, that's just going to be true, right? And I think it's going to come down to Lindor versus Ohtani, and I find this really, really entertaining. Being a New Yorker, I'm not a Mets fan, but I do follow the Mets pretty closely. Lindor is like the most underrated player. Mets fans, until maybe 6 weeks ago, have never really respected him enough. And I don't know if that's because he's gotten off to slow starts in the season a couple of times that he's had to dig himself out of. Batting average is lower than it used to be, which is true for pretty much everybody. And the fact that he's actually in the mix for an MVP now is really satisfying to me because I've always loved him. He's a Hall of Famer. I said this a couple weeks ago and Mets fans lost their minds. I'm like, I guarantee you he's going to be a Hall of Famer. He's going to be the only player in history to be a regular shortstop outside of A-Rod, depending on if you consider him a third baseman or not, get 300 homers and 200 steals. No one has ever done that before as a shortstop. He's going to get there. Now, is he going to win the MVP this year? Probably not. I think Ohtani is still going to win it. And I think that's going to be another notch in the belt of his greatness, I guess, because if you look at his previous two MVPs, part of the argument has been, wow, that guy's a really great hitter and he's a great pitcher. Oh my God, that's wild. Well, he's not doing that this year. He's not pitching, right? He's just going to do this without no defensive value, no pitching value. It is just on the strength of his bat. And obviously the stolen bases are going to matter too. I think he's going to win, but I think it's going to be closer than people think.
And he's got you mentioned the 40-40. He might go 40-40, 100 runs, 100 RBI, and he's not far off hitting 300. Like this might be the most, we're just going to hit every even end point. We're going to have the cleanest looking baseball card line of all time for Shohei. Okay, let's pivot off these MVP races. We'll check in again on them. By the way, here's a warning for Jays fans. If you're sorting by WAR, Matt Chapman would be on your MVP ballot in the National League, by the way, if that's how you were voting. So just to beware of that one. Okay. I wanted to talk to you about the piece you wrote about outfield defense We were going to do some manager of the year stuff too. It's Pat Murphy in the NL, my Uncle Pat. So let's do the outfield defense thing. Man, when you dove into this, obviously here in Toronto, we've been spoiled the last couple of years, right? Dalton Varsho, Kevin Kiermaier, even historically, Jays fans have been pretty sweet. Kevin Pillar, Vernon Wells' peak, Devon White, who we all grew up on, the outfield with like George Bell and Jesse Barfield back in the day. We're spoiled here. But when you look around, and it's Varsho, it's PCA, it's Ciani, Jacob Young, like there's so much speed and athleticism in the center field position now. How much of the offensive decline that we've seen, or the inability to get like balls in play back up as an exciting play and stuff like that, comes down to these center fielders are just too good, man?
Yeah, it's mostly that. I mean, even the names you listed off, setting aside the Blue Jays names, how many of your listeners know who Jacob Young and Michael Ciani are, right? Even Pete Carl Armstrong. I knew him because he was a prospect and in the Javi Baez trade. But the other two guys, I barely even knew before, like, you know, last winter. And that's what stood out to me, that these guys were piling up these insane defensive metrics. And I'm like, well, I got to go find out what's happening here. And when I did, it got really interesting, because when we talk about the decline in offense across baseball, which people usually look at batting average, you know, a lot of different ways to do it. What do we talk about? We talk about strikeouts, right? Well, that was true for the first 20 years of this century, but strikeouts have kind of plateaued over the last couple of years. And for a while, we talked about the infield shift, because it was very visible when you saw a third baseman playing deep right field. Well, strikeouts haven't gone up, and the infield shift is no longer allowed, and batting average has not really increased by all that much, except for a couple of left-handed hitters. And when I looked into it, there is a huge, huge decline of batted balls finding hits in the outfield. Like, you cannot buy a hit in the outfield grass. And there's a couple of reasons for that, right? The first I thought was, well, positioning, everybody's got the cards. And I don't think that's true anymore. I think there were huge gains in that, maybe starting in 2015 or so up until the pandemic. But I don't think that that's much of a difference maker anymore, because everyone's good at it. And I can tell you what it is, Blake. It's because outfielders have gotten, especially center fielders, have gotten younger and they've gotten faster. And what we've learned is this: route running doesn't actually matter that much. I think of Jackie Bradley Jr. a lot. He was not a good route runner. He was elite at reactions and getting a good jump and worrying about catching up to the route later. And that's what we're seeing. We got all these young guys, insane speed, great athleticism, better ways to evaluate them in great positions. And all of a sudden, if you're not hitting a home run, you can't get a hit in the outfield or the infield. So what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, it's the lowest batting average and slugging on balls to the outfield that we have in the measurable era. So going back to 2002 is as far back as I looked. The lowest batting average and slugging on balls in the outfield. It's crazy. And Pete Crow Armstrong's a good example. I broke him down on Blue Jay Central on the weekend. I'm like, yeah, his routes aren't very good, but his burst, like how quickly he gets up to top speed and closes in on that ball once he figures the route out, is crazy. The other thing I should note when it comes to center fielders having an impact on offense is, again, going back to 2002, this is the worst hitting crop of center fielders that we've ever had as well. So teams seem to be embracing, hey, center field is a position where, whereas shortstop has always been a premium defensive position, but there's a real offensive bar to cross for it now as well. Teams seem to be willing in center field, hey, Dalton Varsho, you're going to 95 WRC plus this season, or OPS plus this season. Great. That's awesome in center field. Are you noticing that as well?
Now, I think to some extent what's happening is the center fielders are so good that they are pushing guys who maybe 10 years ago would have been center fielders into the corners, right? Like, if you remember when catcher framing became a thing, all of a sudden you could quantify it and you're like, oh, Ryan Dumit, you're not allowed to catch anymore. Like, you're killing us back there. We're not going to let you even do it anymore. And that happens in the outfield too. Like, you think about 5-6 years ago, you know, Kyle Schwarber doesn't play the outfield anymore, right? Adam Dunn is not allowed to play the outfield anymore. There's probably a version of not terribly distant history where like Vlad Jr. might have been asked to play left field, you know, like that doesn't happen anymore. And so now you've got the guys that used to play center who can play corners, or you've got guys who are at least competent defensively who can hit in the corners. And if you have center fielders who are this good, I don't want to say you don't care about offense, because that's not true, but if your defense is that elite, you just don't have to hit that much to make it worth it. And I think that's what you're seeing with like a Pete Carl Armstrong.
Yeah, and you know, who knows, Pete Carl Armstrong's 22, maybe he finds the bat or whatever, but like Jacob Young's Jacob Young. Like, we know who he is. That's what I would have thought about Brenton Doyle too. And now he's figured out how to hit in cores a little bit. So who knows? Man, last one for you before I let you go. The last Sunday Night Baseball alt stream that you and Trevor May and Kevin Brown have been doing is this coming Sunday, the Orioles against the Astros. How much fun have you had with them? How much are you looking forward to Sunday?
We've had so much fun. They're on ESPN2, and as I say that, I absolutely have no idea if they're viewable in Canada or not. So
well, not,
I certainly hope so.
Not no. in a way that I will say as a Rogers employee.
Yeah. Gotcha. Totally understood. I will say I want my work to be viewed. So in any way you can possibly go out and find them, I encourage you to do so. It's been a lot of fun. We've got a second screen. Kevin and Trevor May has been great. You know, was a pitcher as recently as last year. And he's amazing because he's comfortable on screen. He does all these YouTube videos. He obviously has pitching experience and he knows as much or more than I do about a lot of the pitching metrics and stuff, which is fascinating. So it's been a lot of fun. Got some cool graphics. And yeah, we've done four games and Sunday is our last one. And we've really enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, also a lot of fun. I'll see you early next week down in New York, man. Looking forward to it.
Yes, we are going to go see Pup and we're going to go see Jeff Rosenstock in Williamsburg. I don't know if you've been to Williamsburg, Blake, but I can tell you when I was like 25, it's where I spent all of my time. And it is the quote unquote cool place to be. You will fit right in.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm looking forward to a show at the Warsaw. I've been through the neighborhood, but I haven't been to a show at the Warsaw. So looking forward to it. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Yeah, Blake, see you next week.
Mike Petriello of MLB.com and MLB Network. You can find him on Blue Jay Central tomorrow as well. Always chipping in with those Blue Jay Central hits, the same ones that I do, or John Morosi, Madison Shipman, Alana Rizzo. So always fun to talk with Mike. Let's take a break. When we come back on the other side, always fun to talk with Shai Davidi, who had a lengthy chat with Chris Bassitt and Arden Zwelling yesterday. If you saw and reacted to Bassitt's comments on the Chris Rose show that were, you know, I went back and listened to the interview. He said what he said, but also some of the stuff, as you'd be shocked to learn, that made it to social media as little clips, didn't have the full context. Shai and Arden talked to him at length. We'll hear more about that conversation. We'll take a look at a few more of your texts as well. Shai Davidi next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL.
The J.D. Bunkus Podcast.
Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, joined now by Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. Ton of great work on that Angels trip. Ton of great work sitting down with Chris Bassitt yesterday. Shai and Arden spoke to Chris Bassitt for a little extra context, a little extra insight on the comments that were making the rounds from the Chris Rose show. Shai, good morning, man. How are we doing?
I'm all right. How are you, Blake?
I am good. So first of all, thank you to you and Arden for getting some clarity and expansion from Chris Bassitt on those comments that I'm sure most of the audience saw or heard about. We'll talk a little bit about Bassitt expanding on that. What was when you and Arden go up to Chris and want to clarify on some of that stuff? What was his attitude to demeanor? Like, was he kind of expecting needing to clarify something like that after the way the interview had been chopped up on social media?
My guess is that he expected to have some follow-up to it. And he was very open to discussing it. And we spent quite a bit of time with him. Talking about that, we also talked a little bit about some of the conversation around the potential for a six-inning minimum for starting pitchers as well. So we spent some time talking about that with him too. But look, I think he understood that his comments had been perceived one way, and we discussed with him about what he intended to say, and he was more than accommodating to talk about that.
So in terms of that is in line with how I've experienced Chris Bassitt, a pretty thoughtful and very honest guy generally. What insight were you able to glean from, you know, what his actual intention with those comments were and how he and the other veterans have felt about how this season's gone?
Well, I think there's a few things, right? Bottom line is that he spoke a lot of truths in what he said.
Yep.
And I don't think that it was wildly divergent in terms of what he intended versus what landed. I think to me, the comment that most people jumped on was there were some things that you just can't fix. And you know, what people perceived that to be as major problems, and his explanation was there's some variables that are just fact, and that is the injuries they've suffered, the ages of certain players, those kinds of things, elements that were more situational than structural, and some of those things aren't going to change because, yeah, I mean, he's not getting younger. Kevin Gausman's not getting younger. The toll on Jose Barrios' arm isn't getting any easier. Bo Bichette and Jordan Romano aren't getting uninjured. They can heal, but you can't just snap your fingers and have them back and healthy and productive. And so, the loss of the bullpen, the entire bullpen, essentially, there are certain things that you just can't fix in the course of a season. And that was in his explanation of what he intended from those comments, as opposed to there being some major flaw within the club and the front office that is unrepairable. And so, this has obviously been a frustrating season for players, fans, everybody around the team. And I think there is maybe a bit of a disposition to want to look at the front office and say, okay, there are major problems here. But that's in Chris Bassett's explanation, not what he intended.
Yeah, which I think, makes sense. And the fact that, the issues that he is talking about are things that we've talked about on this show that you and Ben and Arden have written about. They're not... It's not like he's giving away state secrets by saying that he's 36 or that Kevin Gausman's pitched the fourth most innings in baseball over the last decade, right? It's not, those are not new revelations. When it came to the Ohtani part of it, I'm only asking this for the sake of us checking the box that, yes, we clarified Bassett's comments on Ohtani. You didn't make much extra of that either, right? To me, even when he said that, it was pretty clear that it was more like, hey, there was no plan B on the free agent market. If you didn't get Ohtani, you were piecing together some other things. Was that your read and his intention as well?
Yeah, and look, that is valid. Now, could the Blue Jays have perhaps done a couple things differently? Sure, and to me, the one that I look at the most is Teoscar Hernandez, mm-hmm. right? And that is, if you take the money to Justin Turner and to Kevin Kiermaier, you put that together, I mean, that's Teoscar Hernandez right there. And maybe it's a little bit different. You had to do something more. But my understanding of how that played out is that that wasn't something that was pursued. And that would have been a good fit in a number of ways, especially because the guy has some history, guy has some power, he gives you some answers in the lineup. I think that one's one piece of the offseason that you can fairly relitigate. But, I think if you look at Matt Chapman, for instance, he probably ended up where he wanted to end up all along. And I think the Blue Jays didn't push that hard, but I don't know that there was a sense that that was going to end up with a reunification there. And then, Cody Bellinger, I'm not sure that's a fit either, at least the way that was structured, or at least at the price point that was going to work for the Blue Jays. And so beyond that, what else were you going to do? Juan Soto, that was, the Yankees had more in the farm system to use. They had more pieces or better cards to go to the table with, and that's how they were able to land that. So, and that was done before Ohtani signed. So I think it is reasonable to say there wasn't a plan B or there were no major alternatives, but there are some things that they could have done that would have turned out better. Would it have made a difference? I don't know, ultimately, with what happened with the bullpen and things of that nature, but you could have made a couple decisions differently, certainly.
Yeah, and that's we'll see if they learn that lesson as they head into this offseason. It'll be, and like Bassett laid out, Bo's coming off a calf injury, the starting rotation's a little older and has some miles on them, so didn't sound defeatist, but it certainly painted the picture that we've painted, which is that there's a lot of work to be done this offseason. Not all that surprising there. Last one on this for you, Shai. You guys also talked a little bit, it seemed, about the meeting that John Schneider and management had with some of the vets on this team post-trade deadline, and Bassett came away from that, the way you guys tell it, feeling pretty good about things and about 2025. What do you make of his comments on that and what you've been able to glean of just the organization's messaging to those more veteran guys on the team the last little while?
Yeah, and essentially the messaging, as I've been able to uncover, is just basically that they're not going into a full rebuild, and that they're trying to build around that core group, and that what happened this year, there's something they're obviously going to try to avoid next season. Now, I think that depending on the reaction, I think there's some we'll wait and see, and you know, actions will speak louder to words. But from Chris Brassett's point of view, and he didn't want to get into any of the details, but the one thing that he did want to say is that he felt he appreciated that he was included in that group of players that the Blue Jays want to build around for next year. And so ultimately there's an off season to determine what the next steps are. We know the major questions facing this team. They start with the long-term futures of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette. And what you do beyond 25 is, to me, connected in large scale to those two questions. And if you can, and depending on how those resolve, to me, that also impacts how you're behaving in 25. If you can't get Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or Bo Bichette signed to an extension, then you have to seriously consider altering your plans for 25 this offseason, because you can't, at least I would think, go into the season with both those guys unsigned and run the risk of both of them leaving for nothing more than a compensatory draft pick. And the longer you hang on to them, to some ways that you're probably devaluing them a little bit, if you're not going to be able to compete reasonably. So this is a complicated mix, but at least the messaging was that for the time being, the Blue Jays are looking at 25 as competing, and that group of veteran players is the core that they want to build around.
Shai, this is maybe more of a question for October shows when I'll be off the air, so forgive that. But you mentioned there you don't think you can go into 2025 with neither of those guys signed. It's just so risky, and the trade value and things like that. Could you go into 2025 with one of them signed long-term and the other one you're still figuring out or seeing how 2025 goes?
To me, I think that's a little bit more reasonable, okay, right? Because at that point, there's a worthwhile opportunity cost, and it's not too superstar caliber players. It's one superstar caliber player, and you know that you've got something in place for the future, so you're not completely falling off a cliff, right? So that's why I see that as being a little bit different. And then you can play it out a little bit, and maybe if things go awry, then you could make some moves at the deadline and try to recoup some assets at that point. That would be better than a compensatory draft pick. You just have a little bit more margin, but with two players, it's a shaky foundation to build an entire season upon. And you know, you also get to the point where it's, well, why didn't you extend those guys when you had the opportunity, and how are you going to move forward in this time where everything is riding on this one season? And that's a tough way to perform. And I think we saw a little bit of that in the early part of this season, where so much of the Blue Jays' fate this year was just pinned to Bo, Vlad, and George Springer being absolutely amazing at the plate. And that wasn't a good setup, as it turned out. And the Blue Jays put way too much on them, didn't have enough depth in the lineup around them, and they ended up collapsing in on themselves, you know, for that reason and for others as well. So I just don't think that's a wise setup to go into next year with both those guys on expiring contracts. But I mean, we've seen teams do it before, and we'll ultimately see how it plays out.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a way I want to go into the season, where anytime there's a good game or a winning streak, it's like, well, why, these guys aren't signed. What do you do? Shai, you had written about coming out of the – or in, during the Angels series, the power gap the Jays are dealing with here. I believe as of today, it's still the biggest gap between home runs hit and home runs allowed in all of baseball. Obviously, Jose Berríos is pitching tonight. He's been a part of that. Only Cutter Crawford has allowed more home runs. There are a lot of things the team will need to address this offseason, but is adding home run power back into this lineup going to be front of mind for you come, you know, November, December?
Yeah, I mean, it's however you want to put it, home run impact, slug, just offensive threats. They just need more. Like, it's very clear, and we've been talking about this since last season. And, you know, one of the reasons I pointed to Teoscar Hernandez earlier when we're talking the offseason is really the Blue Jays offense hasn't recovered since he left, right? And, you know, the one thing that one of the points that Chris Bassett made that maybe got lost, but to me resonated a little bit more, is that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is isolated in this lineup and does need someone hitting behind him. And it can't just be all Vlad and Bo. It's, you see the good teams and it is three or four dudes. And, you know, the unspoken in that context is that the fundamental issue, I think people want to look at and say, oh, there's problems with the manager, or there's problems in these other areas. But ultimately, the main problem that has haunted the Blue Jays over the last few years is that their player development, their drafting and player development hasn't sustained them the way that it's needed to. And so they haven't been able to turn over some of their offensive players. They haven't been able to provide enough support or develop enough support around Guerrero and Bichette and Springer. And I think the Blue Jays would have had to accounted for the George Springer aging onto the back end of his deal and having to transfer some of the production responsibility for production onto other players into by this point of his contract. You know, that hasn't happened. And so, yeah, the Blue Jays have to lengthen that lineup. Like, it can't just be Vlad and Bo and, hey, George, at 34 or whatever he's going to be, like, come back and be an all-star caliber player again. Like, that's not going to be a good plan. And that's going to essentially put them in a position to have another year like this one.
Yeah. Which would be intolerable for all of us and certainly for the franchise. Two quick ones before I let you go, Shai. What did Chris Bassett think of the 6-inning minimum idea?
So he feels that at this point, it's still a little bit premature,
yeah.
Because there will be a lot of caveats to it, however it ends up. So it's, you know, if that limit will, or that minimum won't apply if, say, a pitcher has a 30 pitch inning or a 35 pitch inning or allows a certain amount of runs or is not feeling right physically or whatever the case may be, that all has to be worked out. So he didn't want to kind of, you know, speculate too much on it or until it's more fully fleshed out. But as a concept, I think the general principle that he thinks is important and that he appreciates that is being, that is driving this, is that the industry is trying to figure out ways to keep pitchers healthier.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what all this is rooted in. And is that part of an adjustment of the way teams think? Does that incentivize teams to better develop pitcher at the minor league level? Does that maybe change how some of the grooming of pitching at colleges and high schools and into the grassroots levels, does that realign things? And instead of the focus being on max efforting, you know, getting as much velo as you can on every single pitch, are you trying to pitch to stamina a little bit more? And are you trying to be a little smarter how you conserve your energy and conserve the strength of your arm? So I think that's where he landed. Like, you know, as a concept, he thinks is interesting. There are going to be caveats which are unknown at this point. and how it ultimately turns out, there's still a long way to go before that moves from, you know, trial balloon that's getting floated to something that's actually applicable.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, but it would need to be rolled out slowly. So there's a player development component and all that stuff as well. But it's an interesting one. And finally, Shai, before I let you go, I know he's going to be here this weekend, so we'll all get to catch up with him. But how was catching up with Kevin Pillar when you were in Anaheim?
It was good. We had a great conversation, and it's a really interesting story for him this season. From a guy who gets cut by the White Sox a couple times, doesn't really get an opportunity there, lands in Anaheim where there's some people that are familiar to him from his time in Toronto, ends up having a really good and productive stretch there. And he goes from thinking that this year was going to be his last one to perhaps reconsidering if the right opportunity. And he's from the LA area. He grew up a Dodgers fan, but he went to lots of Angels games as well, especially when he was in college. He and his teammates would go to Angels games after practice, imagining what it might be like to play there. And now he's wearing the uniform. So a really neat little story to coming full turn there. And he's been, a good player on a bad team. And it's not the ideal circumstance. Certainly he would love to be on a contender, as would anybody on a team that's playing up the string right now. But he's found a joy in playing at the end of a season in which he thought that it was going to turn out much differently.
Well, that'll be, it's fun to hear. It's nice to see him finding a spot there and having some good playing time and maybe reconsidering hanging him up, because still a treat to watch him. Shai, always a treat to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the time out.
Yeah, no problem. Have a great day, Blake.
Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. He'll be on this series as usual. And again, if you want a little more context on the Chris Bassett stuff from the Chris Rose Show, Shai wrote it up at sportsnet.ca. You can see Bassett providing a little bit more context, a little bit more explanation for those comments. Arden Zwelling also had a good Twitter thread going into some of it for you as well. Let's do a couple texts before we close it up. Howard in Thornhill asks, will Bobichet be traded? You seem sure. Howard, I don't know who you think that text is to. I don't know if how I seem sure. I don't think I've even broached the idea all that much, other than at the deadline when like it was in the rumors, so we talked about it because that's what you do. I don't know. I think it'll probably be explored, because you got to explore every way to make this team better. And if you are far apart on a long-term extension, then from an asset management perspective, you need to do that. It would also be selling incredibly low right before free agency, coming off the worst season of his career. So it would be difficult to trade him and get good value back. But yeah, of course you're exploring that. After a season like this, everything is probably on the table. Someone who didn't sign there has asked, do you think the Jays should continue to sell for the next couple of years or try to be a contender next year? It's not really what I think they should do. They're going to try to compete again next year. Shai kind of alluded to it there. Maybe it's a situation where you're trying to compete, but your fingers over the eject button still a little bit in case things don't go well, particularly if you can't sign Vlad long-term, if you can't sign Bo long-term. But whether I think that's what they should do or not, they're going to try to compete next year. They've got all these new suites. They've got a bunch of veterans signed. They've got Vlad in his prime years. Bo, if he can get back in his prime years, they're going to try to compete next year. And honestly, the long-term rebuild, you have to nail that so effectively, and they've changed some of the rules around it where you can't just Orioles it, and the Orioles nailed every aspect on the position player side. Is in addition, you're likelier to end up the Tigers or the Pirates, who, yeah, have interesting young pieces, but it's taken 7, 8, 9 years to kind of retool like that. I'm extending on the long end for the Pirates there, because they've been in a perpetual rebuild. Chris from Winnipeg asks, are the Jays giving up on being Bichette being a superstar hitter in the lineup next season? I think this is again about a potential Bo trade. I don't know. I don't think it would be a giving up on Bo. I think you have to look at the long-term contract situation. If you can find common ground on that, what is the trade market? How can you make your team better? I don't think they would give up on him after this season offensively, given what he's done in the past and the fact that there were injury related factors. But again, after a season like this, you're going to have to explore every single way possible to make your team better. Let's see if they can get a win tonight. It's Jose Berríos against Carson Spires. Carson Spires has never pitched against any player on the Blue Jays roster. So he'll be him and his 92-mile-an-hour fastball that somehow only allows a 200 batting average will be brand new to the Toronto Blue Jays. Jose Berríos on the other side has faced Jaime Candelario and Ty France a lot. The rest of this Reds team pretty new to Jose Berríos. This is a Reds team that needs that win pretty badly. They are 5.5 out of a wild card. Thanks to Joe Siddle, Shai Davidi, Mike Petriello, C. Trent Rosecrans. Thanks to Amit Mann, Andrew Adams, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a wonderful Tuesday.